This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My first speaker is Dr. Eliza Bandera, and she's an MD, PhD, and with epidemiology with a strong interest in community health. She actually has served as a member of the American Cancer Society in 2006 on the Committee on Nutrition and Physical Activities Guidance for Cancer Prevention, in 2007 in the World Cancer Research Fund International and American Institute for Cancer of the World Cancer Research Fund, and setting a lot of the policies and helping, serving on numerous expert panels. Currently, she's a professor in the, I would just have to kind of read it out from here, is the Cancer Institute of New Jersey, and also associated with the Robert Wood Medical School, and right now is changing, potentially changing its name to merging with potentially Rutgers University. So I think her affiliation might change quite very quickly. So with this very brief introduction, it's my pleasure to welcome her to give a talk on microestrogens in girls' growth and development. Eliza.
So I would like to, first of all, thank the organizers for the very kind presentation, the very kind invitation to present my work. And, of course, I would like to, first of all, acknowledge my collaborators in this work in New Jersey, and particularly Dr. Brian Buckley, who developed the essays, the methods to measure microestrogens, and conducted all the essays, and also Dr. Ian Marshall, who's the chief of pediatric endocrinology, among others. So I'm interested in the period of puberty. As we have heard this morning, is a well-known critical period of susceptibility, and we know that an early age at the onset of menarche is a well-established risk factor for breast cancer. And we also know that there's a major public concern right now with the falling age of puberty in girls, not only in the U.S., but also it's a global issue. And also, we saw this morning mentioned the Institute of Medicine report, Breast Cancer and the Environmental Life Course Approach. And I wanted to point out that the mycotoxin that I'm going to be talking about, ceralinone, was highlighted as a high priority topic. So what are mycotoxins? Mycotoxins are labeled as the most important contaminant in the food chain, and it's a secondary metabolite, a chemical of a fungus that produces toxic result in another organism. And what's important to note is that the fact that you don't see the fungus in the food doesn't mean that the mycotoxin is not there. When I presented this, sometimes people tell me, who will eat moldy bread? You will see the mold and you won't eat it. But the mycotoxin may be present and you don't actually see it. So keep that in mind. So fungal contamination can occur in many different stages during food production. It could be in the field, during harvesting, during storage, not only in the farm, but also even in your pantry. It's like any other fungal contamination or infection. It occurs most likely in conditions of high temperature and high humidity. And the spores may lay dormant for months or 2 years and waiting for the positive condition for and then they germinate. Important also to note that they're heat stable, these mycotoxins. So they're not destroyed by canning or other processes. So they stay there. This is just a diagram, again, emphasizing the different stages during which the mycotoxin can be produced. But mostly what I wanted to show you here, you can see the humans there. So humans can be exposed to these mycotoxins through ingestion of contaminated crops, but also through ingestions of animal products from animals that consume the contaminated crops. So keep that in mind, too. This is a list of some mycotoxins. So this, the ones that I'm studying are not the only ones. Some of them are very famous, like aflatoxins, which is a very common cause, a very well-known cause of liver cancer, for example. Just to put the whole thing into context, so I'm interested in ceralinone, this mycotoxin that I'm talking about. And I want to point out that most of the evidence that we know is from experimental studies, some cell lines, experiments in rats, and there's some studies in pigs looking at the metabolism and that type of thing, but the evidence in humans is almost null. So ceralenone is a mycotoxin produced for fungal contamination of grains, as I said, and the species is the Fusarium species. And they have been shown, again, in experimental animals to produce acute and chronic health effects. It has been labeled for this reason as a mycoestrogen, phytoestrogen, and growth promotant. And at the experimental levels in cell lines, it has been shown to be able to bind to the estrogen receptor alpha and beta and to have a full agonist capacity in ER alpha and a misagonist antagonist in ER beta. So we know from the experimental data that they are capable of binding to the estrogen receptor and biological effects. And we also know that affinity to the estrogen receptor is actually higher than other well-known endocrine disruptors, such as BPA and DDT, but lower affinity than other endogenous estrogens. Ceralenone is a synthetic derivative of the mycotoxin ceralenone that I've been talking about. And this is an agent very interesting that is federally approved agent in the US and commonly used in meat production in animals. And you can see here the cows with the pellets in the ear for the administration of ceralenone. But it has been banned in other countries, including the European Union and countries and Canada. The estrogenicity of ceralenone is very, very high and is comparable to the natural estrogen, endogenous estrogens, but also comparable to DES. And it's much more potent than genistein and BPA. And it has been shown, again, in experimental studies to induce ER beta expression and stimulate growth in human breast cancer cells. This is just an ad for Ralgrow, which is the brand name for Ceranol. And you can see that, I don't know if you can see it from a distance, but basically the advertising says that increases rate of weight and gain in cows. So you will expect that if it has this effect in animals, it should have some effect in humans. Just to show you a little bit of the metabolism that we know, again, this is in animals, we don't know in humans. So you have ceralenone, which is the main mycotoxin that I was talking about, and it gets metabolized to alpha-ceralenol and beta-ceralenol, and these get metabolized in terms to alpha-ceralenol and beta-ceralenol, and then both to ceralenone. And all these compounds, the evidence seems to indicate that they can metabolize to each other, but it's not totally known the mechanism. So that's a question mark there, because we totally don't know. Again, this is to show you there are several studies across the world that have tried to measure levels of this ceralenone in foods. And this, I took this a selection of the studies that were conducted in the US and Canada from this report, the WHO report from 2000. And you can see that it's very variable, but it's there in many of the samples. And these studies are not perfect because some of them, basically, they don't have random samples of the foods. The methods are not totally known. Many of them have very small sample size, like one sample or 18 samples. But the important thing, I'm pointing this out so that it shows that it's there in the food supply. So what do we know about puberty in this compound? So essentially, this period, as we all know here, is very sensitive to estrogen stimulation because of delicate balance at that time. But we know very little about puberty. So the current evidence we have right now is the anecdotal reports in Puerto Rico and Italy that showed that at that point, that was in the late 70s, they found that there were epidemic of precocious puberty, and they attributed to the use of anabolic hormones in foods. However, the levels were not assessed. And then there are two small studies that have been published where they measure levels in precocious puberty girls, and some of them had levels. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about one of them that is normally referenced as the why ceralenone causes puberty. But I'm going to show you a little bit what the study is about. So essentially, this study is an Italian study. And again, I want to emphasize that both Ceralenon and Cerano are regulated in Italy. So what they did is that they took two groups of girls, one in Verragio and one in Pisa, from precocious puberty, that have precocious puberty, group A and group B. And then group C and group D are the control groups. So they measure calendar year, and they measure height and different measures and hormone levels. You can see, if you look at the four columns, that the group A, which is a group of precocious puberty in Viareggio, they were slightly younger from the beginning. Then they measured microestrogen levels, and they found that only in group A, six of the girls have detectable levels and no levels in the other groups. Then they went on to classify the girls with microestrogen levels. They classify them microestrogen positive, and they compare CPP, so central precocious puberty girls with microestrogen positive, and CPP girls with microestrogen negative urines. Blood. They actually measure this in blood. And you can see that at baseline, this slide is at baseline, the girls in group E were slightly shorter, which is similar to what we found in the Jersey Girl study, and I will present my data. And these were the levels of ceralenone in yellow that they found. So again, I want to point out that these are an adjusted analysis. And also I want to point out that this may not be the ideal group to evaluate the effects, because these are girls already with precocious puberty, and they were under treatment already with trifluridine. So it's not maybe the best group to study the effects. And then they looked at follow-up at 3 months of therapy with the treatment and 12 months of therapy, and then they found that the group that were microestrogen positive actually were taller and tended to be heavier. So they concluded from this that ceralenone is a cause of precocious puberty. And again, these are an adjusted analysis. So it's not totally, it's certainly very intriguing results that need to be evaluated further, but I wouldn't say based on this that this is a cause. So what we did, I'm going to present now what we did in New Jersey, in the Jersey Girl study. You can find this in PubMed, it's published in the Science of the Total Environment. So the Jersey Girl study is an ongoing cohort study of peripubertal girls. Recruitment sources that we've been using is pediatric practices, media, community recruitment efforts. And I have to say that the study started like a small pilot, and it received so much attention in New Jersey from the press. Everybody's fascinated. Part of it, I think, is the catchy name of the Jersey Girl study. So it received lots of attention, and it made me expand the study and go from a target area that I had in the Princeton area to expand it to all over New Jersey, given that interest. So the girls in the study are healthy girls, age 9 to 10 years. They have to be New Jersey residents and living with the biological mother with no cognitive impairments. Both mother and daughter need to speak English. And for this analysis that I'm going to be presenting, we use cross-sectional data from the first 163 girls participating in the study. So data collection includes an eligibility questionnaire that we do, an appointment, during which we obtain detailed body measurements. We collect a morning urine sample, a saliva sample. We assess Tanner staging by a physician, but also a mom, independently. We have a main questionnaire that includes questions, environmental exposures and early exposures and all those kinds of things, 24-hour recalls, and then we do an annual follow-up survey. So the dietary assessment are three 24-hour recalls conducted at least one during the weekend and one during a weekday, so to be able to capture the differences in intake. And initially, I didn't coordinate this around the time. So the diet in assessment with the urine assessment, I didn't coordinate. So half through the study, I started to do it. So that means that I have a subset of girls for which I have diet the day before urine collection. So that way I can look at four sources of this thing. So I will present that data. And then for the rest of the girls, I have three dietary assessments at any time before the urine collection. So the average of the three dietary assessments is supposed to represent the usual intake of these girls. For the urines, the moms were provided a urine cup that we sent in a package, and then they were instructed to collect the first morning void of the girl, and then they would bring it to the appointment. Immediately after the appointment, we took it to the lab, where it was aliquoted and stored at minus 70 degrees. And well, at the time of doing the analysis, one of the aliquots was transferred to the Environmental and Occupational Health Science Institute for analysis. For this, I also wanted to point out that we only measure free and conjugated serolinone metabolites for this particular project, and this was limited to limited funding. So keep in mind this, because probably if we measure total microestrogens, the prevalence of exposure and the levels are going to be higher than what I'm going to be presenting here. We corrected for urine dilution using specific gravity. Data analysis, I won't go into details. Basically, we use the standard methods and non-parametric measurements when we needed to do that, and we estimated prevalence ratios using Poisson regression. So the main questions that we had, and again, I want to emphasize, this was the first study ever done in girls. So we had no idea if we were going to find levels or not. So it was a very, very interesting and fun, actually, study to do. So can these microestrogens be detected? And if they are, where are they coming from? What are the food sources here? And do they have an impact? So we got the data, and we started to look at it. And yeah, it was very interesting that serolinone was present in 55% of the girls and total microestrogens in 78% of the girls. And you had there the means and the ranges, etc. I put in purple so that you could compare the levels that we found with the levels in the Mazar paper. Keep in mind that my levels are urinary levels. The Mazar paper is in serum. But you can see that we found higher levels of serolinone and higher level of serolinone, which is not surprising because in Italy it's restricted. They shouldn't have found levels in Italy to begin with because it's regulated. Then we looked at the levels by certain characteristics. And again, this is a small study, so it's not definite, and most of the things were not statistically significant. But it points to certain things that certainly need to be studied in further studies, like with age, not much difference. Interesting that African-American girls seem to have higher levels. There were certain areas in New Jersey that had higher levels than another. And also it seemed to be higher with a lower education and lower income. And there seems to be an inverse association with BMI. Then looking at the food sources, no matter how we looked at it, with type of analysis, beef and popcorn always came as the most important predictors. We looked at it because we have very detailed dietary recalls. We were actually able to look at what brands, what type of popcorn, and it was all kinds of popcorn, not just the microwavable. Because you will imagine the microwavable popcorn sits in the bag for a while, so they were your perfect conditions for these fungus to be produced. But no, it was also in the ones that are prepared, like in the bags. So anyway, popcorn. And looking at total microestrogen, the same thing, beef and popcorn, the major predictors. The next step was to look at health effects, and I had the interest especially in growth and the onset of breast development. So the most striking result was height. There was an inverse dose response you can see here with height, where the girls with the higher microestrogen levels in urine were of shorter stature. So actually it went in the opposite direction that I expected. So it seemed to be more acting as an anti-estrogenic compound. And again, I want to point out too that the ones that came up when I showed the levels, serenol, the ones that are the compound that is administered to the cows, the levels were very, very low. So keep that in mind. So what I'm showing here is mostly from the grain, the contamination, that mycotoxin that contaminates grain. Then looking at the onset of breast development, again, you can see that there's kind of a trend here where the girls with the higher levels of microestrogens are less likely to have reached the onset of development. And I put that the age also so that you can see that the age is very similar in the three groups, so that couldn't be the explanation. And then the next step will do a multivariate analysis when I'm able to control for everything. So even adjusting for age, BMI, the year of urine collection, total isoflavone intake, and I also repeated analysis controlling adding beef and adding the age of menarche of the mother. And they didn't make any additional difference. So anyway, again, this shows that the girls with microestrogen-positive girls, girls that had detectable levels in urine, were less likely to have reached the onset of puberty. So the limitation of this study is that this is a small sample size relatively, and particularly for the food sources, I only have a subset of girls that had the urine and the diet coordinated to look at these things. But I want to emphasize again, this is the first study that looks at these things. And what I want to point out that it seems like it's an agent that is worth taking a look at. In conclusion, what we found is that microestrogens were indeed detected in urines of girls in New Jersey, particularly seralinone, and seralinone levels were negligible. I'm not saying that we don't have to worry about the exposure of the animal products being contaminated with seralinone. We didn't find it, but it's something that certainly needs more study. The main source seems to be beef and popcorn. And what we found that compared to microestrogen negative, girls with microestrogen positive urine tended to be of shorter stature and less likely to have reached the onset of puberty even after controlling for BMI. So our findings overall seem that to indicate that seralinone may have anti-estrogenic effects, perhaps by competing with the endogenous estrogens. And this is similar to effects that have been reported for isoflavones. So while our results are not conclusive, they raise important questions that need to be tested in larger, more diverse population, and importantly, using a longitudinal design, because our study was cross-sectional. So it's really a snapshot of these girls in a time of their lives when they're actually growing. So all, as far as we know, it could be that it's only delaying the age at takeoff, but maybe the effect with final height is totally different. So it's something that really needs to more study. So our future plans, we have this pending application working with the Larry Cushy and the team from the Cygnus study, and some of them are here. We are planning on looking at the other markers. So this will be a longitudinal, so you actually look at growth rate, looking at age and hierarchy, age and menarche, body size, body composition, almost final height at age 15, 17, and growth rate. So we can actually look at the process, not just at a certain time, but actually the age at takeoff and age at peak height velocity, so looking at growth rate. And also we will conduct additional analysis in the Jersey Girl study, and we want to compare levels in California and New Jersey. That may also lead us to some clues. Lots of people to thank in this study, especially all the recruitment and the interest in the community. But, of course, I had to thank my daughter with the inspiration from the study. I started the study based on my interest, not only as a scientist, but also as a mom, because she was going through this puberty period and I wanted to know answers. What should I do for her? And now she's a beautiful teenager. So thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.